TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Anand Giridharadas in Conversation on Wealth versus Democracy, Part 2 of 2. Even though his book, Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World, was published back in 2018, Anand Giridharadas is still in demand as speaker and writer on that topic. If anything, the inequality of wealth and power has grown, and Giridharadas' reach now is international. Giridharadas is an editor-at-large for Time, an on-air political analyst for MSNBC, and a visiting scholar at the Journalism Institute at New York University. On May 19, 2020, Anand Giridharadas was interviewed from his home for the International Festival of Arts and Ideas in New Haven, Connecticut. His interviewer was John Dankowski, a 25-year veteran of public radio. He has hosted Where We Live since the program's inception and has also reported for NPR. This is part 2 of 2, the conclusion of a one-hour conversation. Towards the end of part 1, John Dankowski and Anand Giridharadas had gotten into a heated argument over the efficiency of government. Dankowski was making the case for those who claim that many government functions should be transferred to private companies. Giridharadas made his counter-argument for the efficiency of the federal court system and restated his support for Social Security and universal health care. Here first is a short quote from part 1. Anand Giridharadas.
This notion that the government is all like the DMV inefficient, I'm sorry. The United States federal courts, I think cost $80 billion a year, the U.S. federal courts. Do you know how much economic value the federal courts create? Which business generates a return on investment like the U.S. federal courts? The U.S. federal courts give every person, business person in this country, a complete confidence that if someone like completely fraudulently steals your stuff, you have a place to go. Do you understand how profoundly efficient that is as an investment? Social Security, millions of old people would fall into poverty every single year without Social Security. Which business in America is getting returns like that? Medicare. Who has the overhead in the healthcare industry? Who has the overhead costs of Medicare? Are there parts of the government that are slow and inefficient? Are there some bad people going to government? Sure. Is that any different from finance? I mean, you in Connecticut, you got a bunch of hedge fund people around, private equity people around. How many of them are doing super productive things that improve the human condition every day? I've spent time in Silicon Valley. You're telling me all those people add value to the planet every day?
Why don't we have more faith in government? I mean, why don't we have enough faith in our government to say exactly what you said? Medicare works just fine for millions of Americans. It's actually an incredibly efficient system. Why don't we expand it so that more people have access to it?
I'm out here trying to tell people that they should. Because there has been a story. Think about it this way. If you were a wealthy and powerful, you know, a set of wealthy and powerful kind of robber barons who wanted to increase your share of wealth and power and protect it, guard and keep, as James Baldwin said, in addition to selling successful products, right, you would want to do several things. You'd want to try to have a monopoly in some of those sectors if you could. You'd then need to get some political power to lubricate that, make sure you kept your monopoly. You'd want some senators making sure they're not doing antitrust investigations against you. You would want, you know, just legislators in general to be bought and paid for. You would want in addition, a cultural environment in which people thought that the government, which is your main antagonist as a big business person, taxing you, regulating you, you'd want people to believe in that less and believe in you more. And that has been the cultural project ever since the Powell Memo, which is an obscure but important document from the 70s. Jane Mayer talks about all of this in her book, Dark Money, a book you should all read, that There was an explicit campaign by a group of wealthy families, in particular five wealthy families on the political right, Richard Mellon Scaife, who's appear to be maybe connected to the AEI guy you quoted, Mike, and others. And they specifically took on the mission, the Kochs, others, of discrediting government, defanging government, defunding government. And it worked. And I want to make this point really clear to folks listening, right? The number of folks who are actually Kochs listening to this is probably low, judging from the chat. But I would bet that there's a number of people watching this who sort of passively agree with roughly what I'm saying and generally think, you know, social justice, you know, want to help the least among us, but who have absorbed as a kind of secondhand smoke from the culture, this notion, the government's kind of inefficient. Like the way you described it is exactly the form that it takes in the culture, not a hostile anti-government message, which exists on, but just the sense that like government's just, you know, not all it could be. It's kind of inefficient. It's not a good, and I instead, I'm tired of meeting that talking point on the right of government is evil with this milquetoast version on the left of like, well, it's not evil, but it's kind of slothful.
Well, let me just put a little point on it. I covered politics in this state and nationally for a long time. You see a lot of people who are in government to do things for themselves. And that leads to an awful lot of the inefficiencies. And
Is that different from any other sector of human life?
I completely take your point. And it's not different than any other sector. All I'm saying is that I think that that is another piece of it, is that often government is treated by some individuals who get into government, much like business is treated by people who get into business. I'm going to get something for myself. And if I'm able to do good along the way, great. And unfortunately, there's enough people who take government in that direction that I think it lessens people's confidence in the overall system.
Sure. But the problem I have with that is you're describing something about human nature, first of all, that in any walk of human life, there will be some fraction of people who are not serious, who are corrupt, who are gaming. I actually am not sure there's any evidence that it's higher in government. If you go to the NIH, right?
Yep.
You go to the National Institutes of Health, I would bet a tremendous amount of money that the percentage of people in the National Institutes of Health who are in it for themselves and trying to be on the take is substantially lower than their counterparts in big pharma.
100%.
You know? In some local governments, is that the case? But I don't know, like, I've spent a lot of time with Silicon Valley bros, right? I've yet to meet one who's actually really doing something of genuine consequence in proportion to their self-image, you know? So I'm not sure that you can spend 30 or 40 years telling everybody government's bad, driving a lot of young people away from the idea of public service, leaving it to others, and then complaining that no one good is getting in.
I want to get to a couple of questions. Is there an ethical way to be a billionaire? I love that question. What do you think about that?
Well, I think the ethical way to be a billionaire would be to first, you know, if you're a billionaire, you first should do a complicity audit, right? Because it may be that there are ongoing activities related to your fortune, either the company that helped made it or where your investments are, whatever, where you're actually actively doing harm right now. And we don't first need you to go do some good thing. We need you to first stop doing harmful things, right? So if your $1 billion is invested in cigarette companies or you're a, you know, ethical billionaire who inherited it from a, you know, opioid manufacturer that's still actually selling those opioids and you're not speaking out, that's one thing. Then it comes to, you know, how do you spend that money? And the challenge, the simple mantra I would use is, can you give away that money in a way that reduces your power? Right? The fundamental problem in this society is that people like you have too much power. So is it possible to give that money away in ways that reduce your power? And it's not easy, right? Even if you mean well, it's not easy. You could give it away, you know, if you do the Dalio thing, I mean, obviously you're failing the test, right? You are literally asserting your right to govern Connecticut through your gift. But even if you give it to museums, you start having this say in what kind of art they do, right? The senator from Connecticut is going to give you more time if you're a donor to the biggest museum in Connecticut, and that's not fair, and so on and so forth. So thinking about what are ways to give that actually affect a net shift in power. And some of the things that looks like, just off the top of my head, if you're a rich person who donates to ProPublica, right? Nonprofit, investigative journalism thing that takes on the powerful. It's pretty clear you're not getting any power from that. They're not putting your name on the top of the thing. It's not a super prestigious thing. It's not announced. No one knows who's given to ProPublica. If anything, it's going to have no effect on you, or they actually might investigate your rich friends. They might go after some tax loophole you benefit from. That's an example of a donation where I don't think you're really gaining a lot, and you're actually sort of being a little bit of a traitor to your class, right? Or you give to Citizens for Tax Justice, which is figuring out how to research and advocate for, a tax system that is worse for people like you, where you're actually serving as a traitor to your class. Or you fund, organizations that train people to get into politics in communities around the country. You don't go in and dictate some new education system to some town you've recently adopted because you drove by or something. You give money to organizations that are training people from those communities to be more effective, to have better networks, to have better skills so that they can build power. And the consequence of them building that power is actually the people like you will actually decrease as a share if they become powerful. And that's, again, the kind of giving that's putting your own privilege at risk, putting your own power at risk, and actually affecting and altering in a positive direction the balance of power in the society.
Hmm. You gave this remarkable speech at the Aspen Institute a few years back. And one of the things that you said is you were kind of challenging the people who come to Aspen to think through some of these ideas in perhaps a way that they haven't in the past. As you said, our culture has turned businessmen and women into philosophers, revolutionaries, social activists, saviors of the poor. We are at risk of forgetting other languages of human progress, of morality, of democracy, of solidarity, of decency, and of justice. This idea of different languages of human progress is first of all, it's a lovely turn of phrase, but it does also speak to the idea that we seem to have decided that there's a certain way that we count our value here in America, and it's not necessarily any of those things at the end there anymore. It's not morality, democracy, solidarity, decency, or justice. It seems to have a lot to do with the stock market. I wonder if you can talk more about that idea, because those other languages do seem to be lost a bit.
Yeah, this may be a strange way to answer it, but, Winners Take All was my third book. My first book was a book about India called India Calling. And some of the, the OG fans, like my mom, will have read that one. And I was a New York Times correspondent in India at a time when India was opening up the market economy. There was also a lot of government action to help poor people simultaneous to the kind of free market opening of the economy. And a lot of the human stories I told in the book were stories about some of the positive things that happened amid growth. When a country defined by social hierarchy and people kind of supposed to know their place gives way to a society defined by ambition and people wanting to end up, a different station than they're born in. And so sometimes people come up to me and say, like, you seem to love capitalism in your India book and hate capitalism in your Winners Take All book. Like, what's the deal? Now, actually, there were some pretty critical notes of capitalism in the India book, and I don't think they're really safely, fairly characterizing the America book. But your question reminds me to how I square the circle, which is my kind of fundamental theory of how societies work is that they, like your body, they are defined by multiple organs coexisting and working together in a kind of symbiotic fashion. And when this is working right, the different organs support each other. If one of them gets a little weak, the others might compensate for it a little bit and help it out and get it back to strength. But, your stomach needs your brain needs your stomach, and so on and so forth. And so when I think of capitalism, the business sector, operating on one set of values, good at generating wealth, it's better to be a country with a lot of resources than a country without a lot of resources. Business sector is good at harnessing that. Then you got a kind of civil society sector that's good at calling bullshit, telling truth, holding people to account. You got a government sector that does the things the market's never going to provide, cares for the least among us, sets fair rules of the game. None of the other sectors are able to do that, right? You have a university sector where, you know, you really want knowledge as a society, and you want the kind of knowledge that doesn't always make sense in a short-term way. You want to create some class of people who are insulated from the daily pressures of life to actually think deeper thoughts and, you know, work on things like particle physics that may feel of very minimal use right now or tomorrow or the next day, but a cultivated society needs to have. And so you got these different humors of a society, these different organs of a body working together. And my theory of a society that is failing is when one of those organs starts to operate in a way that is inconsistent with there being any other organs in that society, right? When the stomach starts to say, like, I'm the only game in town, no brain here, no legs here, no nervous system, it's me or nothing, right? And in India, what I was writing about, that was not capitalism at that time, right? In India, the big kind of organ that in many ways was inconsistent with the life force of the larger body was an ancient social structure, was family culture, was the caste system or the residues of the caste system, was ideas of hierarchy, was a sense in the country that knowing your place was the highest end in life. And so when that was this big totalizing idea, I was a fan of anything that was breaking it down. And I saw that in little ways, a bank came to town, little capitalism coming to town, and an Indian dad would say, my daughter will never work. I will not allow ladies to work. And then the dad heard that the opening salary of the bank was double his final salary as a retiree. And he was like, you know what? I've always been a feminist, right? And I celebrated that kind of thing, because if money is what it takes for people to abandon thousands of years of patriarchy in their family, great. And likewise, my problem is not the existence of a business sector, the existence of capitalism. It is the existence of a kind of capitalism that behaves in this country as though it is inconsistent with the existence of government, of civil society, of an educational system that is not fully subordinate to it. I want a society in which there are many different languages of progress, to go to the quote. And those languages of progress are in a way represented by these different humors, different types of institutions. And I will always be an enemy of any of those humors, whether it's the government or academia or civil society or business, trying to eat all the others.
Before we run out of time, I got to ask you about, you know, some of the ideas that are contained in your book and the ideas that you've been talking about over time. I'm wondering how you think any of it changes given the current situation that we're in. I mean, we're all thinking about things, I think, differently. We're not on the stage in New Haven right now. We're at home. We're realizing that our lives are upside down. We got to wear masks if we go to the grocery store. Things might not be normal for quite some time. How do you think this moment changes the way in which we're going to think about inequality in our society? Or does it change it at all long term?
I think what is terrifying and exciting about this moment is that it can go either way. And there's a lot of historical precedent for each of two scenarios. So if you read a book like The Shock Doctrine by Naomi Klein, these kind of crises are often huge opportunities for power consolidation by elites, right? In the chaos, they rush in. You saw with the PPP loans that were meant for small businesses, you had big businesses monopolizing a lot of them, small businesses getting nothing. You know, you have people rushing in. When you got $3 trillion being spent on each round of stimulus, right? Regular people have no idea what's in those bills, and lobbyists are all up in there securing line items in there that are going to help line someone's pockets for decades. Fortunes are being built in this period. So that is a well-known possibility. And by the way, it's already happening. However, crises like this are also reset buttons historically, right? I think you don't get women's suffrage if you don't have World War I. I don't think you get the civil rights movement in the way you do if you didn't have World War II and you didn't send a bunch of black GIs to go fight Nazis and come home to be like, what the hell, guys? So these crises, as awful as they are often these kind of moments that shake a society loose a little bit. And a couple of things happen. It becomes okay, kind of more acceptable to say you were wrong about something, right? If you were Joe Biden right now, you wanted to change your mind on Medicare for All, it would be so much more socially acceptable now in a pandemic than 2 months ago. No one would say you're a flip-flopper to Joe Biden today for doing that in a pandemic. You could just say, I changed my mind, 36 million people unemployed, like we can't tie healthcare to jobs, Medicare for All. And new coalitions become possible, but it requires real political imagination. It requires real visionaries, right? And I think people have to ask themselves when you see a Nancy Pelosi or you see a Chuck Schumer running the Democratic Party in the Congress, is that what you're seeing? Are you seeing true vision? Do you see some of the wisest, most thoughtful visionaries of your time leading the way? Or are there other people out there that you need to raise your voice for? Because if we play this right, I actually think the moment coming out of this pandemic is going to be the ripest opportunity in a generation to end what has been the age of capital and inaugurate the age of reform. A decades long period, you know, of progressive reform, fighting climate, dealing with our racial legacy, rebuilding the American opportunity structure. But it is going to take a real marshaling of organizing power. It is going to take artists and writers and others to really shape the public will to want change on that scale. And make no mistake, if we don't do that, the tie will go to the powerful, right? It is only if this post-pandemic period is met with an extraordinary, ambitious outpouring of public imagination that we have a chance to make the America the country we dream it to be.
We just have a few minutes left, and a lot of people were asking for some of your recommendations, books, podcasts, shows, ideas, thought leaders, people that they should look up.
I mean, a really great book that I've been reading that is not current, but is really amazing to read in 2020 is, you know, what many consider the greatest book ever written about American politics, called What It Takes, about the 1988 presidential race. And Joe Biden is running in that race also. So that's kind of an interesting thing. And it's just this epic, epic Total Access Chronicle. This guy was like in, I don't even know how he did it. He was like full access to all, to like eight different campaigns and deep backstory of all these people. And that's been just a really, really amazing, amazing read. I am actually in a household with a podcaster. I'll tell you about her podcast. It's called, my wife, Priya Parker, is doing a podcast, which is really helpful right now, called Together Apart with the New York Times. And it's about, you know, she wrote a book called The Art of Gathering, and she specializes in helping people create gatherings of all kinds. She's a conflict resolution facilitator. You know, her work is about people meeting IRL, and suddenly that's not possible. And so they created this podcast to think about when you have to do a gathering like this through a screen, which we're all doing all day long now in all kinds of ways, distance learning, meetings, whatever, how do you feel together apart with people? How do you have birthdays? How do you have weddings? How do you do all these things in this time? So that's really fun. I think the other thing to do is to get involved in Senate races right now. You know, we're also focused on the presidential race and will Trump or won't Trump. You know, a lot of you don't even live in a place that is politically consequential because of our silly electoral college system. Getting involved in Senate races, other down ballot races, getting to know and speak for candidates who are really promoting real change, not fake change, is something else that's really important.
Any journalist recommendations? Anybody you're reading?
You know, I haven't read this book yet, but I'm very excited. Just today, Zach Carter, I know, has a new book out on Keynes, which is something I'm really, really excited about. Other books I love, The Argonauts by Maggie Nelson is another phenomenal, phenomenal book that I've been recommending to people. A really fun thing that I've been doing, lastly, I'll say, I have been writing as part of my homeschooling of my five-year-old, writing poems with him every morning. We work on a poem together. He kind of dictates phrases, and I use all of the actual phrases he says, but I kind of coach him through the flow of the idea. So now, how would that make someone feel? What do you want to say then? And then I dictate. And sometimes he says something boring. I'm kind of like, you know, Asian parent. I'm like, you know, that was okay, but find a better way to say that. I go all Amy Chua on him. Good Connecticut reference. And that's been really fun. So write poems with your kids.
Anand, thanks for spending the time with us. I keep wanting to say thanks for being here, but you're there and I'm here. But we're all here right now. I'm glad that we were able to meet this way. And thanks, as always, to the International Festival of Arts and Ideas. So thank you for joining us, no matter where you are, whether you're in New Haven or not. And Anand, thanks again.
Thank you so much.
Cheers.
That was Anand Giridharadas, interviewed at the International Festival of Arts and Ideas in New Haven, Connecticut, on May 19, 2020, by John Dankowski, a 25-year veteran of public radio. Giridharadas is an editor-at-large for Time, an on-air political analyst for MSNBC, and a visiting scholar at New York University. I was curious if I could find a poem his 5-year-old son had written with him, and found this one on Twitter from May 14. Giridharadas introduced it by writing, "Today, in homeschool poetry class, I think my son was trying to send me a message," end quote. And I thought there are more recipients for this message, so here's the poem. Grown-ups should do art. You are working with important calls, and I don't really like that. You're working on your iPad. You're sitting at your desk. You're zooming into your people. And I don't like that at all. Grown-ups working is very boring for the kids. The kids are going to get very sad and cry. And if you work too much, you will get a headache. I've got an idea, and I'm going to tell you right now. And it is doing arts and crafts. Arts and crafts are not only for kids. Grown-ups can do them too. It won't give you a headache. It will make you delightful. You can do things like maybe a baby head with yellow Play-Doh, maybe a family sack out of white paper, maybe rainbows out of crumbled origami paper, maybe a clock out of paper and clay, maybe a jungle out of folded paper and curly paper and purple glue, maybe a rainbow heart with 6 containers, maybe a long poem about the start of Corona time or the end of it. I hope you can do all these things that are arts and crafts with no important calls. This poem was written by Anand Giridharadas' 5-year-old son in homeschool poetry class during the time of COVID sheltering in place. You heard part 2 of 2 of Anand Giridharadas in Conversation, Wealth versus Democracy. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Glurden. Thank you for listening.